This is Bernie Lubbers, the global brand ambassador for whiskeys for Heaven Hill Distillery out of Bardstown in Louisville, Kentucky, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. My name is Souther Teague. Damon Bolte is still in California, so it's just going to be me today in the studio with some guests. But first, I want to touch on a couple of things I need to talk about that I need you to hear and pay attention to. My good buddy Chris Reed, who bartends at Bar Goto, as you've probably heard me mention many times on the show, my favorite bar in New York City, was diagnosed with ALS just this past May, and it is slowly robbing him of his ability to do his job. So we've created a GoFundMe for him. We're trying to raise $250,000 for Chris. We're just over $50,000 right now. So go to GoFundMe, search for Chris Reed, and make sure you give to this guy. He's a real sweetheart, and he's been dealt a terrible hand, and he's dealing with it in the best that he can. Also, applications are open at barmethods.com. Bar Methods is a 101 series that we do each year where we teach classes about all the basics of bartending, from stirring to shaking to ice manufacture, all the basic things you need to get your program up and running. It's a great session. 3 days for a single price. It gets you tons of seminars, classes, dinners, lunches. Everything's paid for once you get here. So it's August 25th to 28th here in New York City. Barmethods.com. Check it out. In the studio today, I've got, man, a hell of a team. A couple of guys from Ireland who have a tiny bar down the lower down the lower part of Manhattan that we're really hoping makes it. It's called Dead Rabbit. Jack McGarry and Sean Muldoon. Welcome to the studio. How you guys doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm well. I'm always happy to see you. Second time I've had you in the studio. Mm-hmm. First time I've seen you in here, but you've mentioned you've been in the studio before for another show.
I think we were in twice before.
Yeah.
Once with Damon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. And then also in the studio, we got Rebecca Dooley. Rebecca, what's your role with this team?
I'm the marketing and PR director, so things like this, and then any kind of pop-ups or events that we do, special launches, like the book that we just released.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a copy of that.
Good. You enjoyed it?
Yeah, of course. I'm about halfway through it. I love the layout, you know, a graphic novel style.
Yeah.
Which mimics your menus at the mm-hmm. Dead Rabbit, right? Mm-hmm. Which way did it go? Book first, then menus, or the other way?
Menus and then book.
Menus were always that style, and then a book came after that. And this is book two, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we just released our latest book as well, so the Irish Whiskey and Irish Pub book.
Books, books, books.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the Dead Rabbit first, and then we'll get further into what's going on upcoming. But Dead Rabbit's been open since 2013, right? Mm-hmm. And within 6 months of it opening, it hit really hard at Tales of the Cocktail, won Best New Bar and Best Cocktail List. Is that right? Mm-hmm. How do you do that in 6 months? How do you crack open a bar in New York City, and then 6 months later, you're known as the best bar?
I like love the way he gives me this wee head as if it's my answer to this question. So listen, Souther, I'm going to be brutally honest. When we came here, we came from Belfast. We had absolutely nothing. We won Best Bar of Tales for the bar we worked in the Merchant Hotel.
The Merchant, yeah.
And Belfast didn't understand this. It's like when you tell people in Belfast you're the best bar in the world according to Tales of the Cocktail, they think you're nuts. They think you're having a laugh. So we came to New York. It was the thing that sold us to New York. There was a guy who used to come to our bar. He worked at the New York City Stock Exchange, and he was a millionaire by the time he was 33. And he said, "You guys are in the wrong place. You need to be in a big city like London or New York." And he was in New York, and he said, "If you come to New York, guarantee you, if you ever do the same thing, you ever win World's Best Bar or anything like that, you'll get so much more opportunity." So we came to New York with that in our mind. We wanted to be the best bar in the world. And I'm just going to be brutally honest, and I'm not being big-headed, I'm not being arrogant about this. That's what we were two guys from Belfast that had absolutely nothing. And we came here with that in our mind. We thought, we're going to go over and we want this opportunity that he's talking about. And so we came here with that intention. We've since changed a lot in 6 years. We've been open 6 years. We don't think the same way that we thought when we first came here. It's not all about cocktails to us, but it was when we first came here. And we very much wanted to win those awards. So when I say to people, it's not, we came here and it wasn't a surprise to us to win it, because that's what we came here for. And we spent 2.5 years before we opened that bar of planning and thinking and living it every single day. We walked through the streets every day with nothing but each other to live off. There was nobody there giving us support, nobody there giving us help. It was me and him the whole way. And we knew that when we opened that bar, we were, as far as we were concerned, the way we talked, we were going to show the world and show the people that didn't believe us before we opened the bar what we were capable of. It wasn't a surprise to us. And I'm going to be honest, that's what we wanted to do and that's what we came here to do. Now, we've since changed an awful lot in the way we think, but that's definitely, back in those days, we wanted that, and we wanted it more than anything.
And you did everything you could do to achieve it, and in achieving it, you were afforded all those opportunities that you expected. Right?
Like the sort of thing I'm talking about, we won Best Bar at Tails, Best New Bar in 2013. And what happens is, 6 months after you open, the biggest culinary book publisher in America is coming to your door asking you want to write a book. That doesn't happen in Ireland. Like, it doesn't happen. It just doesn't. Nobody writes books in Ireland. It's not like nobody in our industry. Maybe a couple of high-ranking chefs would write books, but certainly not bartenders or bartender-related. It just doesn't happen, you know. So that's an example of opportunity that the guy was talking about. It was you get the opportunity, and it's here. It's in the city. It's not in Belfast where we're from.
Right, so you came to a market that was more amenable to what it is you were already doing in a market that wasn't appreciating it. I mean,
yeah,
that's the bottom line.
Well, what the only way I could describe it is I used to go hang about with this guy years ago, and he used to talk in Belfast, and he talked to me about there's Jordanstown's University and there's Queen's University. It's like a university in England, and it's like Cambridge or Oxford. And having a degree in both those places is completely different. It's a degree. To me, who doesn't have a degree is a degree. But to him, having a Queen's University degree is completely different than having a university degree in Jordanstown. And I thought he was full of it. But it's like being the best bar in the world in Belfast and being the best bar in the world in New York is two completely different things. That's the way I can sum this up to you. Being the best bar in the world in Belfast, people think it's a sympathy vote. People think this isn't real. You got to be kidding. It doesn't happen. It's not true. But when you do it in New York, what the guy said was, the investor guy, you're going to meet your match. There's 100 million, not 100 million people, let's say 100 people that think exactly like you that want to be the best. And that they're all in New York. Everybody goes to New York to be the best. And he said, you'll meet your match. He said, and if you can do it in New York, you're really legitimate. It's not like doing it in Belfast and people feeling sorry for you. If you're able to do the same thing in New York, where you're meeting your match every single day of the week, and there's people that go to that city just to do that thing, he said, then people will believe it. And, right. And it's true.
Right, and it afforded you tons of opportunity. The first book was The Grocery and Grog, right?
Yeah.
And that's the book that they came seeking you out?
Yeah, and it's one of those things that that book to me was like, you get people that have opinions on these things. Back then, back in Belfast, I was inspired by another guy, and a guy from Canada. He got me into cocktails, and there was me and him in Belfast that were really leading a cocktail charge when nobody else was doing it. And I thought, tell that story of how I get into cocktails. Jack met me through the Merchant Hotel, but Jack was an amazing, he was a wizard of cocktails. He was an incredible, best bartender I've ever seen in my life. People back in Belfast thought he was like the George Best. I don't know if you know who George Best is, but George Best is like the Irish equivalent of Pelly. And Jack was like the George Best of cocktails. And when you watch Jack bartend, he was riveting to watch. You could have been fighting with your wife or fighting with your husband, and Jack would have distracted you, because to watch him bartend was something truly special. So there was that, and I thought that the first book should be about how I get into cocktails and how what was happening in Belfast back in those dark days, and meeting Jack and then Jack's cocktails. And I thought that would be a good story. And it seems to be that a lot of people look up to that book, because we came from nothing, and it's just it's that story of the boy growing up in a wee neighborhood area in North Belfast that it does well. That's what we were trying to tell the world, you know.
Yeah, hometown heroes.
hometown
so,
heroes.
So now, do you get that respect back in Belfast that you didn't get before? You think when you go back home, are you lauded, or are you?
Yeah, it's like.
Do they want you to come home now?
No, and they're constantly saying, like, and no disrespect, but they're constantly saying, why don't you open a Dead Rabbit in Belfast? And it's just because Belfast doesn't understand it. Not what we're about. But we've changed a lot. It's not just about cocktails now. It's about creating an experience. And before, it was all about cocktails. So we've definitely changed. We've matured.
Matured. What's the experience like now at the Dead Rabbit?
I mean, for us, I think when we first opened the show, I was saying it was purely cocktail-driven. Like, the whole beverage program was historically driven. Everything was, all, like, historic. Nowadays, it's about our whole raison d'etre is about bringing the pub, the Irish pub, particularly with Dead Rabbit, into the 21st century. So everything revolving around that. You have parts of that, like the Irish coffee, the Irish whiskey selection, you have our menus. You have us taking every single detail right down to what's in the bathrooms, how the floor, like every single detail we're completely focused on. So it was just purely this. Now it's everything.
Right.
So I think we came over as bartenders and we've became operators. You know, I think that's the best way to kind of sum it up.
Sure, but I think that's an evolution that would have happened even if you just stayed your ground, right? You mature into that, as you said, mature. You mature into that role, right? You know, I definitely feel the same way. Maury Margo's 8 years old this month, and, you know, we focus heavily on the drinks still, but the experience is what we focus on the most, by far. And you guys have an immersive situation over there at the Dead Rabbit. It's very, like, you're stepping off the streets of New York City and into Ireland.
Yeah.
And it's super immersive. Mm-hmm. Like, you feel it right away. You know, that long, you know, pub room with all the Irish whiskey, the wall of Irish whiskey attacking your sight as you come in the door, like Guinness in front of everybody. Like, it's definitely an immersive feeling when I walk in there. But it looks new right now, right? You had a bit of a tragedy a couple months back. The place next door caught on fire and damaged you, right?
Well,
is that how it went? Was it next door?
No, we caught on fire.
It was you that caught on fire.
Yeah, we caught on fire, yeah.
What happened there?
Well, we still don't fully know the ins and outs of it, but the story that we're going with is it originated in a ductwork, and it came out through the ductwork, went into the kitchen, went back up, and then came out of the ductwork and had basically killed the entire back of the building, so all our electrics and that type of stuff. So it wasn't aesthetic as much. It wasn't in the front of the house. It was more back of house, but it still cost us a good couple of $100,000. We were closed for 18 days.
18 days.
It would have been, if it happened to a smaller bar, it would have been much longer. But fortunately, we had money in the bank that was set aside initially for the extension that we dipped into, and our partners had to put in more money as well. But it was an interesting time for sure. But again, it's one of those things when it happens in New York, you just dust yourself on, come back stronger.
Yeah, you got to keep moving. We've got friends who've had bars who've burned, or the team over at the Donna, Black Crescent. They just have to like muscle through it and come back.
Mm-hmm.
Same for you. But it was right at a time when you were about to expand anyway.
Yeah.
So the comeback involved the expansion, or the comeback, the expansion was later, right?
Well, we got the building at the tail end of the year before. We were starting to work on it. So we were initially, it happened in the kitchen, but we'd already purchased the equipment for the kitchen to go into the basement of the next door building. So that was, it happened when all this was happening. But then when we had to pull the construction team off, demo and construction to get the bar back open. So it put us back by about, I'd say about 6 weeks. It put us back 6 to 8 weeks, and then the money ran out. So we had, like, it was stressful, stressful time.
And I'll just be like chiming in on that, and I know that I'm anybody that's serious about their operation. It's everybody's worst nightmare that you're going to go home at night and your building's going to go on fire, because you see it every single morning when you wake up in the news. A building in Brooklyn or a building in Staten Island has caught fire, and you see the damage it's done. And our building is an old building, it's 200 years old, and you just know it's your worst nightmare. And there's nothing, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen, but you do everything you can to prevent it. But it's one of those unfortunate things, and we're very, very lucky, because just immediately after our building went on fire, a building went on fire in Belfast City Centre, where we're from. Primark, it was the busiest Primark in the whole of Europe, as far as I'm aware. It caused damage beyond belief, that practically the entire Belfast City Centre closed down because of this one building. It's a landmark building, but it's a special building, and what it did to Belfast in the last year was remarkable, like really, really bad. But so many people lost their jobs, and it was burned to the ground. Like, it was a real, real serious fire. So we consider ourselves very, very fortunate. The fact that we were only able to open again in New York in 18 days, it was nothing short of remarkable.
Yeah, outstanding. When you reopened, did you have the kitchen at that moment, or did you open without a kitchen for a while?
No, well, we still had a fairly extensive food operation, but it was all cold items. It was solids, sandwiches, bar snacks. So I was actually very surprised when the chef showed us the menu, because it was still fairly extensive considering they literally had one table that they were knocking all this food out of. and we were still doing decent food sales, but the business took a hit.
We were down a quarter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we would normally make in a normal week, we were down a quarter because of food.
What a drag. But great, speedy recovery, and then now the extension is open. I haven't been to see it yet, but I've heard great things about it. It's just the ground floor that's extended now?
So we did it in three stages. So obviously when we got the bar reopened, the focus was to get the kitchen back online. So all the energy went into getting the kitchen open. So we got the kitchen open, I believe, at the beginning of December. And then the focus went into getting the extension open, the taproom extension, because that's where we're going to get that area is going to contribute more to the revenue and the experience overall. So that was the next that opened at the end of December. And now the parlor extension is open this Friday. So we focused in three separate areas.
You said this Friday?
This Friday,
Oh, it's not even open yet?
Yeah.
Oh, so okay, great.
Yeah. The parlor extension.
Yeah. So I'm not too late. I'll come see it all when it's
all
done.
So the parlor extension will open then. After that, we'll be focused on the staff, and the staff are in the management space. So because we've dedicated half of the second floor for staff and management, the work and change and all that type of stuff.
Amazing. Wow, man. That's a luxury in New York City to have space to offer just to the staff.
Yeah.
You know, my space, not a chance. We got nothing. I got nothing. I recommend people don't bring their coat in with them. Yeah. Like, there's nowhere to put it. So that's an incredible thing to have. Well, we're right about the mark where we take a break and hear from our sponsors. So let's do that. We'll come right back with the team from the Dead Rabbit, Jack McGarry, Sean Muldoon, and Rebecca Dooley. We're going to talk about upcoming St. Patrick's Day. We'll be right back.
This is Bernie Lubbers on the Speakeasy on Heritage Radio, and sipping on some bourbon. And some of the bourbons that I like to sip on is old authentic brands, and that's what we are at Heaven Hill Distillery. And one of those brands is Old Fitzgerald. It is a brand that distiller Pappy Van Winkle made famous after he bought it during Prohibition and brought it back afterwards. And so Larceny Bourbon is the bourbon based on Old Fitzgerald. It's the small batch version of Old Fitzgerald. So when you see Larceny, notice it's a fairly new brand. It's only 6 years old or so as a brand, but the whiskey and the heritage is from Old Fitzgerald, which is an old heritage brand that has heralded the worldwide. It's a gem in our portfolio. So if you haven't tried Larceny Bourbon, you should.
Hey there, seems like you like podcasts. My name is Eli Sussman. I'm a chef and restaurant owner, and I've got a great podcast right here on Heritage Radio Network called The Line. On my show, I interview chefs and restaurateurs about the trajectory of their career. It's a one-on-one conversation where we talk about where it all started, to where they are cooking now, and everything in between. You can find The Line everywhere you get your podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we are back on the Speakeasy. Today we've got the team from the Dead Rabbit with us, Sean Muldoon, Jack McGarry, and Rebecca Dooley. We've been talking about the Dead Rabbit and its rise to fame and popularity here in New York City and in the world. We didn't talk at all about Blacktail. You want to touch on that a little bit? And then we're going to talk about St. Patrick's Day.
If you have a question, we'll answer it.
I mean, Blacktail opened... how old is Blacktail at this point?
2 years old.
2 years old, yeah. More of a Cuban theme. What made you go with that theme? Like, what two guys from Belfast, the first thing I think of is daiquiris.
I mean, so Sean has a big fascination with Ernest Hemingway, so there was that part in terms of his story in Cuba. But the big thing is definitely in Ireland, there's an affinity between Irish people, Catholic Irish people, and Cuba because of the relationship, the way they perceive it, the relationship with imperial kind of forces and powers and that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's obviously quite a dense story. But there's that thing with Cuba, Sean's Ernest Hemingway thing, and we started doing trips. And when it came to the time of like entertaining another bar, we didn't want to do another Irish pub because that would have been the easy thing to do. And
why do the easy thing?
So we wanted to do something slightly different. And Sean had this idea of doing the American story in Cuba before the revolution. So just before Prohibition, right in the start of the revolution, because there was an amazing Irish story there, our American story in terms of the entrepreneurs going there, the hoteliers, the bars, the luxury bars. So that was really the story of Blacktail. But Sean will go into greater detail in terms of the Ernest Hemingway side of things.
No, it's just one of the, both of our bars, the Blacktail and the Dead Rabbit. They are like, Dead Rabbit is an Irish American story. It's a story that happened in New York. The Dead Rabbits existed in New York. And Blacktail were small airplanes that you could have got to, you could have hopscotch, is that the name of the game? You could have hopscotched across America with these, like, that's what they call it, the Highball Express, like the Orient Express, where you get a plane to a connecting airport, they connect an airport, and you basically hopscotch right across America to get to Cuba during Prohibition. The planes operated from, I believe, 1920 to 24, but from 20 to 22, they were called the White Tail Fleet, because all the tail fins of the planes were painted white. And then some marketing guru came in and seen them from the ground and said, we need to paint the tail fins black so that people can identify them. And they were called the Black Tail Fleet. But it was just a very interesting, and it happened in New York. And I think if you're going to tell a Cuban story in New York, it needs to be New York related. And I think the same with an Irish. If you're going to tell an Irish story in New York, it needs to be New York related. So that's what seems to be why people dig it and why people own it in the city, because we're not an Irish bar from Ireland coming to New York. It's a New York story. The Blacktail is a New York story. It happened in New York.
Right.
So that's what I think makes them both work.
And it's such an opulent place. Like, it's so, I don't know, overbuilt isn't the right word, but like it's really built up. Like, when you come in, it's kind of like, again, stepping off the streets of New York City and into this like grandiose Cuban experience.
Yeah, it's very immersive.
Yeah, what happens? Like, I mean, you've got out each side of the windows. If you were to open the blinds, you've got the Freedom Tower, the World Trade Center, the Freedom Tower. You've got it right on one side, and you've got the Statue of Liberty on the other side. And people would come in and say, here, the views are amazing in here, but there is no views because we close the blinds. You're not supposed to be in New York. You're supposed to be in Cuba.
Right.
During pre-revolution. But yeah, it's grandiose, but it's grandiose, I think, by New York standards. It's not grandiose by like European standards. When European bartenders and stuff come to the bar, they completely identify with it. Mm-hmm. It's nothing to them. This is the sort of bar that they know and they appreciate. It's very different and grandiose for in New York, because I think in New York we like our bars to be small.
I don't know if we like it. That's what we're stuck with.
It's what we're used to.
Real estate is expensive.
And I'll be honest, like when we first opened Blacktail, we didn't get favorable reviews from the press and stuff like that, because it was so different and it was so, as you say, people were saying it was like a mafia kingpin's mansion and shit like that, and people were talking about this and that and the other. But listen, it's what it is, and it's what we want it to be. And the thing is, it's different compared to other bars in New York, compared to this place we're in, for example. It's completely different, and I understand that. But when people from Europe and people from London and stuff come to the bar, they do identify with it a lot easier.
Well, yeah, every time I travel in Europe, you go to all the hotel bars and they're incredibly
like that.
Opulent.
Yeah.
High ceilings, chandeliers everywhere, lots of woodwork, marble. And I think that's, you're right, for us in New York, it's a little unusual. You go to smaller markets that have more real estate for less money, and you get things like that. But
Well, the thing about us, though, we're aware of that, and we're aware, like, when people say it is, it's, we know what makes it different from a New York standpoint, and we appreciate that, because it's the way things are over here, but it is what it is, and it's the bar that we want it to be, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it's beautiful. I've been there a couple of times. I was there actually the very first night, friends mm-hmm. and family. Mm-hmm. I saw you there. And it's now, what did you say, 3 years old?
It'll be coming up on three.
Now, yeah. You going to have a big party?
No, we'll have a party when it's 5 years old.
Yeah.
We used to have parties every year, but I think we've decided we're only going to have them on major celebrations. So the 1st, the 5th, the 10th, that type of thing, you know?
Yeah, I like it. You know, I don't do anything. Ever. We're 8 years old this month. I'll say it forever, but we're not going to do anything.
Yeah.
The big thing with Blacktail is that our menus, we're moving away. We wanted to tell the story of Cuba from 1922 to 1959. So basically when Americans started going to Cuba during Prohibition, right up until the Revolution, we wanted to tell that story and make people aware of that story through menus and this, that, and the other. So we're moving away from history. And we're going a much more cultural route. We're going to be starting to celebrate everything, even today, that Cuba is known for and celebrated is its music and dance. So we're opening an outside space in May, beginning of May, which is pretty cutting edge. For an outside space, it's pretty cutting edge. It's done right, and it's another 180 seats.
Whoa.
It's going to be open 8 months of the year, and music is going to be a big, big feature. And this time, you will be seeing this. The Statue of Liberty's right there, and the cruise ships are just going past in the Hudson River. But it's
because right, you're on Pier A, for people listening. It's on Pier A, which literally sticks out into the water.
Mm-hmm.
So the bar sticks out into the water. So I know the outdoor space that you're talking about, where you're going to have it.
It's right,
kind of right on the water,
right to the side of the door of right to the left of the door when you walk in Blacktail.
Yeah, which is. It's going to be gorgeous, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Opening in May. Outstanding.
So the whole thing is going to become much more music and dance focused. And so it'll be music, dance, cocktails, and food. That's what we're trying to do over there.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And again, it's a real sense of escapism that you guys build in your bars, you know. Mm-hmm. Stepping, you know, into your places, again, out of downtown Manhattan, and you're in Ireland suddenly. And that hospitality comes through, and that the vibe comes through again in everything that you see in front of people and everything that you see on the back bar. It makes a lot of sense. America is about to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Well, the world is, I guess, but America's going to fuck it up. And you guys are here to set the record straight. What is St. Patrick's Day supposed to be? Because, you know, I think our picture of it is let's get Chicago to paint the river green. Let's drink a bunch of green beers and get, you know, really wasted early in the day. It's like SantaCon, but with leprechauns.
I mean, you guys have made it much more of a celebration. We don't have, like, parades. You guys definitely started the big, massive parades. But St. Patrick's Day, if I were trying to explain it, it's for an American side of things, it's definitely closer. The way that we celebrate it would be the way you guys celebrate Thanksgiving. But it's much more community. Like, you'll close off streets. The whole street will party together. But it's not as emphatic in terms of its alcohol consumption. That's definitely... the American side of things, and I'd say the paddywhackery in terms of the greenness and the green nut, we don't do that back home, obviously, because we are Irish. We don't need to kind of to celebrate it that way. So for us and Dead Rabbit, it's all about celebrating the authentic St. Patrick's Day. It's the banter, it's the crack, it's the music, the product, obviously, in the Irish whiskey, the Irish coffee, the Irish whiskey cocktails, Guinness. But it's doing it all without the kind of the Santa Connie, like that type of thing. We try to get rid of all that, so because that's not what it's about for us.
To me, when I was growing up, St. Patrick's Day was like you went to the shop and you bought a little badge, and it was like it had the colors of the Irish flag with a little harp on it, and you stuck it on your coat. You went to mass, and as you get older, you didn't go to the mass, and you just had pints with your dad in the local bar. That was St. Patrick's Day. You probably watched sport on the TV or something, but it was not like you went out and paraded or went to a march or anything like that.
Well, I think in slight defense of the American approach, it's a way to sort of recognize Irish heritage. That maybe the people that are putting on these parades maybe are from or they associate with Ireland in some close way, but then it just got out of control.
Yeah.
It spiraled out of control where it's just everybody gets on the bandwagon and tries to make it into this great day of drinking. That's what we do with everything. Everything in America eventually heads back to drinking.
Yeah, but listen, there's a big parade in Dublin. It's not beyond like, it wouldn't be the size of the one in New York, but they definitely are like what. But that doesn't really happen anywhere else in Ireland apart from Dublin.
Yeah, and I would assume that the parade in Dublin is a little bit more reverent, whereas the parade here is just a big party of people dragging through the streets.
I mean, remember the first time I came over here and Sean took me to the parade? I was like, never going to be back at this again. Because it's just the way people were getting on that day was bonkers. Like,
I've never been
drinking, it was just hardcore.
I've lived in New York for 18 years. I've never been to any parade of any kind because I lived in New Orleans for 3 years and Mardi Gras is enough.
Yeah.
the big thing that we do St. Patrick's Day is we totally depend on our Irish clientele all year long, every day of the week. It's not like St. Patrick's Day, let's milk it, let's get as much money to these people as we can. We actually give back on St. Patrick's Day, and it's a day that we seriously do not have to give back. We do like half-price Irish coffees and things like that, and we don't have to do it. It's just because we want to do it. Our Irish audience, our Irish followers, our Irish fan base are really, really important to us every single day of every single year, and it's St. Patrick's Day is no different. We want them to come. The thing that we think we do in Dead Rabbit is we give people from Ireland, for New Yorkers, we give them something different. It's a different type of Irish bar. For people from back home in Ireland, it's a home from home. They come here and they identify with it right away because these are the type of bars that they're familiar with. and we do things well. We do things as well as we humanly possibly can. And they appreciate that. They know that we go to the lengths. They're the people, as I said earlier, they will tell us every good thing we do and they will tell us every bad thing we do. They are our number one. They tell you everything. Rebecca deals with these people on a daily basis on social media.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll tell you, like, they will tell you everything you're doing wrong and everything. We just opened two snugs, which is like two booths in our extension. And when you eventually do come, you'll see what I'm talking about. But they were telling us, oh, you have to give them names. Oh, you have to give them names. And they were actually telling us what
the
names
snugs have to have names.
according to Irish tradition, they have to have names. None of us knew this, but we were being told they have to have names. So we give them names. We named them after our mothers, my mother, his mother. But we wouldn't have even known that, only they told us. It's just that they pay attention to everything we're doing. They want us to do everything right. They want us to represent them right. And they keep us guided. And I'm
keeping you honest. It sounds like it's at least it's constructive criticism. They're not just bitching at you.
People would be telling Rebecca, "I'm coming over for St. Patrick's Day 6 months in advance. Can I come with kids? Can I do this? Can I do that?" And it's a 6 month plan for a lot of these people. So listen, all we want to do is do what's right by them and give them the best possible day that we can, the best possible experience. We're not out to rip people off or charge people extra. We want people to come to the bar and have a great time and a great experience and a great memory and go back to Ireland raving about the bar. That's all we want.
Yeah. I'm shocked that you have such a contingency of Irish visitors from Ireland come to see you, but then also Irish residents come to see you.
It's like we get a lot of New York residents.
That's what I mean. Irish residents of New York.
I wouldn't say Irish New York residents necessarily. We get some, but we get a lot of a New York following, people from New York that come to the bar regularly. And then we get a lot of Irish in UK, people from London, people from England. We get a lot of those people as well. And other American states, obviously, but Irish is a big, when it comes to tourists, Irish is easily, I'm talking about people coming for the weekend or the week, easily our number one tourist group, easily.
Wow. Huh. Does that hold true at Blacktail? You got a lot of Cubans in there? Probably not.
No, well, it's starting, listen, but it's starting to get that way. And the reason, the people who tell us that, or the people who tell me that particularly, are the doormen, because they're both Spanish. One is from Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. Freddie's from Puerto Rico. And where's he? From Salvador. And basically they tell us, because they're speaking to these people when they're leaving every night. Funny story, how patriotic people can get. We recently started music on a Wednesday, and it's a Brazilian band, Brazilian singer, and they sing Portuguese, not Spanish. And the doorman would tell you when the Spanish people are leaving, people from Cuba, people from Puerto Rico, when they're leaving, they would complain about the Portuguese person speaking, singing, because it's not Spanish. And you're just thinking, like, this is how much these people own the place. It's like they're telling the doorman, because they're all Spanish, that they have a problem with it should be Spanish, not Portuguese. You know, it's just that type of ownership.
Yeah. Well, that's good that you know, your guest feels entitled enough to give you some feedback. You know, I've always said when I'm opening my bars, you know, I plan my work, I work my plan, I remain flexible. Mm-hmm. Because once I get the doors open, the people are going to come in and tell me what it is. Mm-hmm. Right? They're going to drive the business.
I just want a good experience. And if it's Portuguese, it's Portuguese. If it's Spanish, it's Spanish. It's just, I just want a good experience, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's like you got close, but you missed their mark just by that little bit. Rebecca, you find them to be it's criticism that's constructive, or is it just they're yelling at you?
It's
name
usually,
the snugs. Why aren't you naming the snugs?
It depends. One thing that on Deb Rabbit's social media is always contentious is the Irish breakfast.
Uh-oh.
So anytime we put up a picture...
Is it the wrong bacon?
It'll be... Well, Sean and Jack will know. There's different types of Irish breakfast.
Yeah, it's the most contentious post we ever put up.
Yeah.
Because... There's such a thing. It's crazy, but there's such a thing. There's a Scottish breakfast. I don't know what a Scottish breakfast is, but there is a Scottish breakfast. It's probably got haggis and mushrooms.
Yes, it does.
English breakfast, I'm pretty sure, has beans and mushrooms.
Yeah, English breakfast. But my mum says it doesn't have beans, but I would have it with beans. See, even an English fry up is. People argue about it.
But English always has tomato, right?
Yeah, yeah. But an Irish one.
So
does
Irish
as well,
breakfast is the way we got the way we think is the Irish breakfast, which is the south of Ireland. It would have white pudding, black pudding, bacon, sausage, tomato, and eggs, obviously fried eggs, and maybe wheaten bread. Mm-hmm. The Ulster Fry, where we're from, it's the Ulster Fry, and it's not called the Irish breakfast, but the difference is that it has potato bread and soda bread, and it does not have wheaten bread. and it doesn't have black and white pudding. So that's the difference. So we put up a post about the Irish breakfast.
Just for the listener, by the way, black and white puddings are not pudding. They're meat.
Yeah, we actually went through
it's blood, sausage, and
sausage
and,
meat.
And boudin, basically.
So basically, we go through it. We put up the post because we've so many people that follow us from where we're from in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and stuff like that. They would criticize this breakfast because it does not have the potato bread or the soda bread. And it's not an easy thing to get over here. It's we have to make it ourselves. So we literally started making our own soda bread, and they actually sent us the recipes. And they said, this is the way it is. You've got to have the potato bread and you've got to have the soda bread, and here's the recipes, and all from these top chefs, by the way. It's not like some wee local. It's top chefs sent us these recipes. And the next time you put up the picture, make sure it has the breads. So now, it's one of those pieces of advice, like the snugs having names, that we're prepared to listen to. The Portuguese music thing we're not prepared to listen to because it's just music. But this is something we've got to listen to because there's people who are actually taking offense at this.
Well, it's the fact that you guys really seem to approach the thing on a level of minutia that you know equates to attention to detail, mm-hmm. right? And I also would hazard the same guess that if you put up a cocktail recipe for Hemingway Daiquiri at the Black Tail, people would be like, oh, no, that's not a Hemingway if you didn't include maraschino liqueur or mm-hmm. if you didn't include grapefruit juice or whatever. Like, it's, you know, you found a pretty fun crossover between the food and drink world where we're all kind of nerdy, mm-hmm. right? And if you're posting up like, this is a true dish, and then you're missing a component that someone believes is factually the truth, then now we've got a contention,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, definitely the potato bread.
But that's fun. I think that's fun. Mm-hmm. So I think you should post 5 days of Irish breakfast and have all the different. On Mondays we have soda bread. On Tuesdays we have black pudding. On Wednesdays we have tomato, and on Thursday we have beans. Right?
That's actually a good idea.
Right? Just post them up. Be like, which day are you coming? how far have you been running lately? I know you do a lot of running.
A lot. I'm running the New Jersey full marathon at the end of April, so it's like 50 or 60 miles a week at the minute.
50 or 60 yeah. miles a week.
And then Sean's doing the New York half marathon, so he's running about 30 to 40.
Half marathons are not the same as marathons, so it's like a marathon, to me, is bad for you. He can do it. I couldn't do it. A marathon would kill me. But half marathons, to me, are challenging enough, but I enjoy doing them.
How many marathons have you run at this point? How many full marathons have you run?
Like 6 or 7 at this point now.
Jesus. Yeah. First of all, how can you not remember exactly? If I'd run 6 or 7, I would know it was 6 or it was 7 because it killed me.
My sister in Ireland, she's run like over 30 marathons, and she's nothing but pains in her legs and things like this. And I'm just thinking, I don't want to be there. I just do not want to be. And it's not like she's breaking any records or anything. She's running marathons in 4 hours, 10 minutes, whatever. But I know it's fast, but it's not like, to me, it's like you're running 30 marathons, 40 marathons to run it in that time. I just wouldn't do it. It's different if you're trying to achieve 3 hours or something. I'm just talking from my perspective.
Sure.
She's obviously got her own reasons for doing this, but she's got all kinds of pains, problems with her feet, and it's just somewhere I don't want to be.
And you don't care. You want to run.
No, I mean, for Sean's sister, it sounds like she runs a lot a year. I only run 1 or 2 marathons a year. Because if you're running more than 1 or 2 a year, you're going to get into problems.
But I see on your social media, you run a lot, just generally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always running, yeah.
Yeah, that's.
But I'm not running, like, if you're running like 5, 4, 5, 6 marathons a year, you're going to have problems.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah, I think you have a mental problem right away.
Well, I mean, you can sign me up for those too, sure.
When you're not training for a half marathon and running 50 miles a week, how many miles a week do you generally run, just on a regular average?
Normally about 40.
So not much less.
Yeah, but
two miles a day.
Yeah, but the extra 10, 20 a week really,
turns it up.
Yeah.
How many calories of food do you consume a day during that time?
Like 3,500, 4,000 a day.
Wow. Man, that's just beyond me in every way. I can't even. I wouldn't be able to eat that much, and I damn sure wouldn't be able to run that much. I was a athlete when I was young. I was a skateboarder, sponsored skateboarder for Vision Streetwear, and I destroyed my ankles and my knees. I couldn't run from here to that bar over there. But good for you. That's amazing. Do you have any aspirations to run like the New York Marathon? Have you run that?
I've run that like 3 times.
Oh shit! Yeah. Really? I thought that was a hard one to get into.
Yeah, it is. But you can get in. You find a way.
Yeah, you got a little sway with the
New York
Marathon.
He knows people.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. host a party at the bar or something like that. Yeah. Swing it right in there. Well, what else you guys got coming up? Anything new on the horizon we can talk about? Well, you got your book just came out.
Yeah.
I'm going to have Jillian on and talk about the book more specifically, but it's your book as well, right? Mm-hmm. The three of you wrote it. All three of your names are on the cover.
This is the Mixology and Mayhem you're talking about?
Yeah,
that came out a couple months ago, and then we just released the new book as well as the third book.
What's the third? Okay, I'm getting confused. So two came out in 3 months?
Yep.
Oh, Jesus. All right, what's the one you're talking about?
So you can talk about the whiskey book.
No, I'll talk about the other book.
Yeah,
I'll talk about the menu book. So listen, we've always taken menu seriously. We took menu seriously when we were in the Merchant Hotel as well. We won best cocktail menu when we were in the Merchant Hotel. It's just something we've always invested in and always believed in. And the also was like, it's part of the experience when a guest comes to the bar and they see the menu. Some people are put off by menus and put off by stories of menus and the fact that I have to know what's going on here. It should be just a straightforward list. It's different strokes for different folks. Some people are really into it and some people aren't into it. Most of our guests are into it. But we've always been into menus. And what we noticed was in the last 4 or 5 years, there's a lot of bars spending a lot of money on menus, particularly in Europe, if I'm going to be brutally honest. There's a lot, you can see that what I believe started the type of way we go about menus, I believe it's impacted a lot of other bars, and there's a lot of other bars across the world that are taking menus really, really seriously. Not everybody does. Again, it's a bunch of people, but they do take menus very seriously. And if you look at these awards, it's always the same people that are in the top 10 because it's always the same people that are investing and believe in the same thing. But we felt it would be good to just show behind the scenes, basically. Like, it's like making a film. What goes on in our world when it comes to creating menus, from what Jillian does with the drinks and the staff, down to what it comes with the design team and how the inspiration starts in the first place. And we just thought it'd be good to tell that story to get people a real behind the scenes peek about the processes and the lengths we go to make menus, because it's just interesting in this day and age when people are taking menus seriously. If people weren't taking menus seriously, then we wouldn't have done the book.
I think Jim Meehan in his book says that a cocktail's name is the only marketing plan that cocktail has. Right, there are plenty of great cocktail names that were attached to not so great cocktails that have still gone on. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of terrible cocktail names that have been great cocktails that have disappeared. Right.
Yeah.
So the cocktail name is the only marketing plan that a cocktail has, according to Jim Meehan. I think going further is the menu itself is kind of the only marketing that your list has.
Yeah.
Right. And also it's an engaging piece that you literally hand to every single guest. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you can make that something that makes them excited or interested or put a story behind the drink, then all the more chance that the next time they come in they'll have an entryway into your menu already. Mm-hmm. Last time I was here, I remember I had this thing that had something to do with something, and then you can say, oh, here's where we went with that on the new menu, whatever. Speaking of menus and drinks and St. Patrick's Day and the Irish coffee, there's a couple of bottles of Bushmills sitting here on the bar. Let's talk about Irish coffee. What are you guys doing over there?
You can talk about the Irish coffee.
You can talk about the Irish coffee.
No, you love it.
I'm tired of talking. You can talk.
Two shy Irish guys.
Okay,
more in the world.
So listen, Irish coffee with us, it started, we've always been serious about the Irish coffee. It started, my love affair with Irish coffee started 20 years ago in London. Dale de Groff was doing a presentation and at the London Bar Show. And he could have chosen any drink in the world, and he could have chosen any topic in the world. And this was at a time when, like, Dale de Groff, for us in the UK, in Ireland, he was a real, real celebrity. Like, even being Dale de Groff's company, for me back then, was like, this guy was like a superstar.
He still is.
I know. But like, now when you're here in New York, it's much more like on a friendly business. But back then, you didn't know who he was. You'd heard about this guy, and it was just like, you were in awe. And the thing that he did, and he didn't have to do again, was make an Irish coffee. And he asked the question to 100 bartenders in the UK, how many of you have had an Irish coffee before? And they all put their hand up. And then he says, I'm going to ask a second question. How many of you had an Irish coffee you actually liked?
Mm.
Which is an amazing question. I just can't get past that question to this day. It was mind-blowing for him to be asking that question like 20 years ago in London. And nobody put their hand up. And he says, exactly. And he says, I'm going to tell you why. And he told the whole reasons why Irish coffees have been a disaster in the past. And he was talking about Irish coffees in America at that time, but it was the same for Irish coffees in Ireland. We just did a tour of 160 pubs in Ireland, proper, authentic, traditional Irish pubs.
You guys were in some kind of crazy little van, right?
Yeah. but we asked, Rebecca, we asked out of curiosity for Irish coffees, and we knew that most of them weren't going to make them because it takes too long in their minds. But we asked out of curiosity. And out of the ones that did make them, I would say out of every bar that we went to, 10% of bars were able to make them, and 90% didn't make them. And I would say that out of the 10% of bars, so we're talking 16 bars, four of them were probably good, five of them maximum. And ones that you could have drank, like the whole drink is what I'm talking about, but it's just a drink that hasn't been taken seriously in Ireland. But it was Dale DeGroff that inspired, like told us how to make, first taught me that an Irish coffee is actually a beautiful drink if it's made right. It has to be treated like a cocktail. It has to be, it's all balanced. It's all proportion. It's this versus this versus this. And it's always in a 6 ounce glass. It's what he said back then. We've since talked to him. And he says, actually, I would say an 8 ounce glass because most people have an 8 ounce glass in their house and they don't have a 6 ounce, like a wine glass. He says, so you've got to think for the person in the house. But at the time, he definitely said that it was a 6 ounce glass. It was a smaller pour. And he proportioned it all. He talked about the cream. He talked about the coffee. He talked about the whiskey being used in the drink. And it was really, really important. So we had a serious Irish coffee in the Merchant where we worked, and it was good Irish coffee. People talked about it. But then when we came to New York, we didn't come here with any intentions of having this amazing Irish coffee or anything. We were put in a position where eight people came into the bar one day when we'd just opened and asked the bartender working downstairs for eight Irish coffees. And we weren't ready for it. And it's the same as any bar in Ireland. They're not ready for 8 hours coffee. Right. It's like a real, it throws a spanner in the works when you're not ready for it. She was knee deep already with all these cocktail orders coming in. And she was the only bartender on walking downstairs during the day. And she had to get me to shake the cream. It was just a disaster. And I remember thinking at the time, we're here trying to be this amazing cocktail bar, and yet we're not ready to serve your Irish coffees for people that are coming in an Irish bar asking for your Irish coffees. And it was that incident that made me and Jack sit together. We've got to address this and make sure it never happens again. So we thought we've got to have Irish coffee ready for volume in a situation where we're asked for 10, 20 Irish coffees. We've got to be ready to make them because we can't ever allow that to happen again. So it was the Irish coffee thing at the Dead Rabbit was created out of necessity. Now we've developed it and developed it and developed it. And Jack could probably talk to you about all what we've went through to make the coffee what it is today. But it started out of necessity. And it's the same as what I was talking about earlier. Irish whiskey knowledge in general. When we first opened the bar, we had a big Irish whiskey collection. We didn't know the first thing about Irish whiskey. And I'm going to be brutally honest. Most people in Ireland, I would say with the exception of one bar, and I could name the bar right now, Garavan's in Galway. With the exception of that one bar, I would say if you go into any bar in Ireland right now and you ask about Irish whiskey, not just to give me an Irish whiskey, like what, tell me the difference between that and that. Nobody would know. And it was the same with us. As soon as we opened the bar, we'd just opened the head of St. Patrick's Day. It was this time, like 6 years ago, people, mm-hmm. journalists were coming in. Jack was behind the bar and were asking me on the other side of the bar, right, tell me about Irish whiskey. I don't know anything about Irish whiskey. Tell me how it should be drunk. Tell me the difference. And I hadn't got a clue. And I said to Jack, right, we can never be caught out like this again.
Right.
So it was that situation.
You're an authority. You need to have the authoritative answers.
We weren't authorities, and we just wanted to have a big collection. Well, us, it was all about cocktails. It was not about, sure. We just wanted to have Irish whiskey in the back bar. But you can't come to New York and have a whole lot of Irish whiskey and not know anything about it.
Right.
It's like you not knowing about the stuff that you do in Amoria Margo is you've got to know your product, you know. So it was born out of necessity. We had to go and learn it because people were expecting of us. And in New York, you could get away with that in Ireland, you get away with that in Belfast, but you're not going to get away with it in New York. You're going to look stupid if you don't know what you're selling.
How many Irish whiskeys you guys sell on an average week or
so
day?
So we're selling 1,200 a week at the minute.
Irish coffees.
So it's 1,200, and then but the aim is obviously with the extension is to get that up to 1,500 a week. So that's over, you're talking anywhere between this year, we're looking 65,000 to 75,000 Irish coffees.
Wow.
And obviously the base is Bushmills Original, so obviously we're from Antrim. So it's patriotic to have the Bushmills blend in there.
What's the build? What's the coffee you're using? What's the sweetener?
So the sweetener is Demerara. Uh-huh. The base part's obviously Bushmills Original. The coffee is Sumatra. So it's Indonesian coffee. And then the cream is the cream. For the cream to work, it has to be over 36% fat content for it to float with just being lightly whipped. So we whipped that in a, it's just whipped in a, like a protein shaker. Yep. The ratio between the sugar and the coffee is about 5 to 1. And that's sitting in a water bath. So it literally, you, by the in building this, you can build 15 of these in the space that would take you to pour one pint of Guinness.
Wow.
You know, so that's how quick.
We've streamlined it so much. That's outstanding. I mean, that's, again, digging into the minutia of something and making it a total immersive.
And then we've
experience.
Even got it to the point that the same one person is making the coffee and sugar, because there was slight differences between, because we had it that the barbacks were making the blend in the morning, the blend of the sugar and the coffee, but each one of them was doing a slightly different. So we've delegated the one person who's our prep guy. And he does it, he's in 5 or 6 days a week, so the day that he's not in, he just does a double batch. Mm-hmm. So that's how seriously we're taking it.
It's amazing. Yeah, and I think when you're dealing with a coffee cocktail, you got to bear in mind, because, you know, I used to do a coffee program mm-hmm. at Amore for 2 years called Double Buzz. What we found out pretty quickly was, because we did an entire service, that every cocktail was coffee-based.
Yeah.
And we found out pretty quickly, like, you can have one or two or even three too many drinks and still be okay. One too many coffees is too many coffees.
Yeah, yeah.
So the balance of coffee to cocktail has to be correct in such a way that you're not going to give people the jitters. Guys, it's been great having you in the studio today.
Thanks for
bringing some Bushmills for us to drink and talking to us about everything that goes on at the Dead Rabbit and at Black Tail, and as well as the books. I didn't even realize the second one came out. I'll get on ordering that one. I have the Cocktails Mayhem book at my house. And thanks, Rebecca, for chiming
Thank
in
you.
With some of the constructive criticisms that you get from your audience. Where can people reach you if they need to get in touch with the Dead Rabbit?
Rebecca at deadrabbitnyc.com.
Man, you were just thrown right under the double-decker bus.
deadrabbitnyc.com,
Jack at deadrabbitnyc doesn't work.
Yeah, and you have social media that's just Dead Rabbit, right?
At Dead Rabbit NYC for everything. Yeah,
NYC's
Instagram,
on the
Facebook,
end.
Twitter. Yep.
Dead Rabbit NYC. Cool. So mm-hmm. check out the team at the Dead Rabbit Black Tail. Thanks for tuning into the Speakeasy today, and guys, once again, thanks for being in the studio with me. It's great just chatting
Thank
with
you
on like a friendly level. Good to see you. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
With your rock and roll load, knows that country music's gonna save your soul.
Want more of the Speakeasy? Follow us and ask questions on Instagram at Speakeasy Podcast or on Twitter at Speakeasy Radio. You can find Damon at Damon Bolte, and you can find me at Creative Drunk on all platforms. Take a moment to write us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite platform, and give us a star rating, 5 if possible. If you're visiting New York City or a resident, stop by the studio and hang out with us during an episode. Reach out beforehand to make sure we'll be here. We'd love to see you. And please support our show by visiting heritageradionetwork.org and clicking on the beating heart to donate.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners just like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. I'm